Going to make it? First, the EMT shrugged. Then he shook his head. And then he climbed into the bus and closed the doors. I had wanted Swanson to tell me who else was in his crew. But I had a strong feeling that even if he'd lived, he wouldn't have given his people away. Chapter 97. Ambulances were coming in, taking away the injured. The ME's van had arrived, and Claire was talking to Clapper. CSU had barricaded all but one slim lane of the road. Techs were setting up lights in an evidence tent, and investigators were working the scene as best they could under the circumstances. According to Brady, the body count was 4, and all of the dead were unidentified shooters. One car had gotten away, and the number and identities of the people inside were unknown. I'd sat in my car, and after I'd checked in with Joe and with Conklin, I called Nancy Swanson.
"I have to see you," I said when she answered.
"What happened? Did something happen to Ted?"
"He's hurt, but he's alive."
"What happened? Tell me! Now!"
"I'll be at your house in 15 minutes. I'm driving you to the hospital. Get someone to watch your kids." Her phone clunked to the floor. I called her name, but she was screaming and calling to her children. I took the quickest, fastest route to the Swanson house, thinking that now, maybe, Nancy would tell me what she knew. She was standing at the curb in a man's white shirt, jeans, and bedroom slippers when I pulled up.
"Which hospital?" she asked me, getting into the passenger seat. "What's his condition? Is it serious?"
"Buckle up," I said. The car shot off the curb and I set my course for Metropolitan Hospital. Nancy clenched her fists and beat her thighs as I told her about the standoff at Oswaldo Vasquez's house. I told her Vasquez had called her husband in a panic, saying that a number of cars had driven up to his house and that he perceived them to be a threat. I said that by the time Ted and I arrived, a full-scale shootout between the police and the men in those cars was in progress.
"He was safe in the car with me," I told Nancy. "Then he jumped out of the car and ran toward Vasquez's house." "Oh my God, that's when he got shot?"
I nodded. "He was down but not out when the EMTs arrived."
"This is all your fault," she hissed at me. "Damn you, Sergeant."
"I understand what you're going through, Nancy, and I feel terrible for you."
"I don't care how you spin it. You've been crowding Ted for weeks now, and he's never done anything wrong. Anything he did it for us. His family."
"Do you understand the truth? Your husband is a criminal." She scoffed and said,
"The real criminal is Kingfisher."
"I don't understand what you mean."
"He's the one who had the Calhoun family killed, or didn't you know?"
"Do you know this for a fact?" I asked her. Nancy Swanson covered her face with her hands. Her neck and arms were red with welts. She sobbed.
"I don't know. I don't know. I have 3 kids. We can't lose Ted. He has to live. Do you understand?"
I said, "Nancy, can you tell me anything that might help us get the shooters?" She turned her burning eyes to me and said,
"Are you out of your mind? I'm a cop's wife. Don't you think I know what you're trying to do?"
I stopped the car outside the emergency room, and Nancy unbuckled her seatbelt, opened the door, and took off at a run. My phone began buzzing before I could close the door. It was Brady.
"Vasquez is missing," Brady said.
"He doesn't answer his phone. His house is empty, Boxer. He's just gone."
Chapter 98. The next morning at 10, Conklin and I took the drive to Park Merced with 2 uniformed officers following behind. Nancy Swanson opened the door. She was wearing the same big shirt and jeans she'd been wearing yesterday, and from the look of her eyes, she'd been crying since then, too. I introduced Conklin, but she didn't look at him. I handed her the search warrant, and she stepped aside, snapping,
"What do you have against Ted? Do you even know how he's doing?"
"Have you heard from Vasquez?" I asked her.
"If I had, you'd be the last person I'd tell."
Conklin and I went through the house, which looked cheerful now with daylight coming through the many windows facing the greenery of Villa Merced Park. We gloved up, and with Nancy watching, Conklin and I searched the den. We found a trick panel in a bookcase. There were innumerable banded stacks of $20 bills inside. One of the uniformed officers uncovered more cash under the frozen food in the basement freezer. And Conklin uncovered a cache of guns in the bedroom closet, under the carpet below a trap door. I turned up more stacks of money in the dishwasher. Nancy had stashed it there in a hurry. Swanson's car was included in the warrant, and I turned up 5 passports and some cash in a trap inside the dash. We bagged and tagged everything. While we packed up, I called Jacoby. He sighed loudly and said,
"I love you, Lindsay."
I had to laugh, and so did he. Once we were back at the hall, we went straight to Jacoby's office with our cartons of Swanson's stuff. Jacoby picked up the phone, punched in a number, and said,
"We're ready for you, Sergeant."
A few minutes later, we were comfortably seated on Jacoby's leather furniture, telling Phil Pekelny what we had found at Ted Swanson's house. Pekelny was lean, maybe 35, an East Coast cop from New York or Boston. He had no discernible accent, and he had a good haircut, handsome clothes, and nice shoes. Swanson, Vasquez, Calhoun, and Robertson had reported to him.
"This is unbelievable," he said. "How much money was there?"
"Looks to be like a million or so," I told him. "Between that, the guns, and the passports, I'm guessing that Swanson was leaving soon." Phil said,
"I completely trusted Ted."
Jacoby asked Phil what he knew about Vasquez, and he said,
"I liked him. A lot. And I would say that my opinion of Vasquez now means absolutely nothing. I have no idea where he might be, and he certainly hasn't called me."
Conklin and I stopped off at the property room and signed in $1,000,002 in U.S. currency and a half dozen assorted guns. After that, we briefed Brady on the Swanson house hall. Brady had just gotten off the phone with the hospital. He said,
"From what I could determine, Swanson is hanging on by a frayed thread."
He also told us that Brand and Whitney were in the wind, not answering phone calls, not going home.
"Vasquez is still missing," Brady said. "The car that got away from Nagley was found in a ditch off Highway 92 with about 100 bullet holes in the chassis. There was blood in the back seat. The lab is working it up."
Had Vasquez been murdered or abducted, or had he just gotten a ride out of town?
"Why don't you two take the rest of the day off?" said Brady.
It was 5 in the afternoon. I don't remember the last time I'd gone home at 5, but this was good. I had plans for the evening. Chapter 99. I had a terrific red dress hanging in my closet. I'd bought it before I got pregnant, without an event in mind. It still had tags on it. Joe was still out with Martha and Julie when I got home, so I showered and put on my makeup, including eyeliner and mascara. The red crepe dress had an asymmetrical neckline and hem, and a fitted waist. I slipped it on, stepped into a pair of low heels, and looked at myself in the mirror. I didn't look like the same woman who wore chinos and a blue blazer every day. Wow! This was me, too. The Women's Murder Club was meeting at a bar and restaurant called Local Edition. It was officially a Women's Murder Club Welcome Home Cindy event, and we were also celebrating Fish's Girl getting a mention in the LA Times. These were fine reasons for the four of us to spend some quality time together. I left Joe a note and headed out toward the restaurant. One block later, while I was negotiating traffic, my phone rang. I glanced down and saw unknown caller on the faceplate. I was stuck between a Porsche and a panel van, so I took the call. The voice was muffled, but the message was clear.
"You break the blue line, you get what you deserve. You and your family aren't safe, Boxer. They'll never be safe."
My blood stopped flowing through my veins and dropped to my feet. "Who is this?" I said. The line was open. I could hear static, but there was no answer. I stared at the rear end of the Porsche, but I wasn't seeing it. I was picturing the face of a cop. One cop in particular.
And you're not safe from me, Vasquez. There was a click as the call was disconnected, and at just about the same instant, the driver of the panel van behind me blew his horn. I put my foot on the gas, wondering if I'd been right when I said Vasquez. But whether my caller was Vasquez or some other vicious hater, I wasn't going to let this call ruin my evening. That was what I told myself, but I felt a tremor, an internal earthquake, a shifting of my sense of security in my own home. It was almost intolerable. So what was I going to do about it? Chapter 100. Yuki had picked the perfect venue to toast our crime reporter friend on her return from her triumphal book tour. I parked the car at a metered spot on Market and walked a couple of blocks to the historic Hearst building. The doorman escorted me down the stairs to the subterranean room that once housed the San Francisco Examiner's printing presses and was now a dark and glamorous club. The ceilings were high. Typewriters lined the walls. The long bar was of polished wood, with rows and rows of wine glasses hanging on overhead racks by their stems. Looking around the perimeter of the room, I saw red leather booths facing white leather swivel chairs across white marble tables, and a number of huge presses were still on the floor, adding to the 1950s feel of the place. I released a long sigh. I was going to drink and laugh tonight. That was for sure. The doorman showed me to our table, and I was about to sit down when Yuki appeared and fairly danced across the floor. I was reaching for Yuki when Claire called out, "Hey, you two!" and joined us in a three-way hug. When we were seated, we said, "Phones off!" in unison, and when we had done it, Claire said to Yuki, "I heard you've got big news." Yuki had already called me about her settlement for her client, but it was a great pleasure to hear her telling the story to Claire, using her hands, imitating Parisi's voice.
"When he signed the agreement, he said to me, 'You really are a little shit, Yuki.' And I said, 'I learned from the biggest and the best.'"
And then Yuki laughed her joyous, infectious chortle, and we laughed with her, loud and long. When she got her breath, she said,
"Then he winked at me."
"Did he?" I asked.
"He did. He winked. He smiled. He passed the document across the table and said, 'Have a good day.
I think you will.'"
"He adores you," Claire said. "He still totally adores you."
Feeling her presence before we saw her, we looked up to see Cindy wearing slinky black, smelling of lilies of the valley as she leaned down, hugging and kissing all of us.
"Who still adores you?" she asked Yuki, sliding in beside her.
Yuki got to tell the story again, and as Cindy had been out of the loop, she heard the long version. She laughed and asked for more detailed explanations, which broke up the dramatic flow, but hell, Cindy is a reporter, and facts are her thing. Then Cindy said,
"I've got a little news of my own."
"We know your book got great reviews," Claire said. "What else you got?"
Cindy said, "I found this next to my clock this morning."
She pulled a black velvet box from her handbag and put it on the table. There was a collective gasp. We'd seen this movie before. The first time, Richie had gotten down on one knee in the nave of Grace Cathedral. He had proposed and had given Cindy his mother's ring. In her telling at the time, the angels sang and doves flew through the church and she knew she was blessed. Then after the pre-honeymoon period, when the conversation turned to children, she and Richie had hit a thick brick wall. What had changed? Cindy opened the box and pulled out a fine gold chain with a sizable diamond pendant.
"This was the ring," she said. "Richie had it made into something different, just for me."
Cindy fastened the chain around her neck, then held the stone in its simple setting and slid it back and forth on the chain. That stone was a gasper then, and it was a gasper now.
"So you're not engaged?"
Yuki asked Cindy, the only one of our group who was still single.
"There was a note with the necklace," said Cindy. "Richie wrote, 'When we're ready to get married, we'll pick out a ring together.'"
"Beautiful,"
Claire said. The diamond and the note.
That calls for a drink, said Yuki.
The waiter appeared and recommended several house special cocktails named for people, places, and headline events in the newspaper business. We toasted everything. Cindy and Richie's renewed commitment, Yuki's settlement for the Cordells, Claire's baby girl's admission to first grade. And as for me, we toasted the fact that 9 months after Julie was born, I could pull off a skinny red dress fabulously. It was customary for the four of us to discuss our cases, but I just wasn't up for sharing numero uno in the Windbreaker crew. Not tonight. I held up my phone. I'm just calling my husband to say I'm on my way. I punched in Joe's number, and when he answered, I said, Hey, I'll be home by 9. Chapter 101. Rich Conklin was waiting in a patrol car, parked in front of a row of 3-story wood frame buildings on Stockton Street in Chinatown. All the buildings were occupied by ground floor retail businesses, while the top floors were mostly residential. From where Conklin was parked, he had a full view of the downstairs deli-type greengrocer and the door next to it, which was the entrance to the lobby of the Silvestri Hotel, a rent-by-the-hour flophouse. Conklin knew this place pretty well, having busted drug dealers and prostitutes there when he was a beat cop, before Lindsay got him moved up to homicide. What he remembered most about the Silvestri was that the rooms were pitifully furnished, with dirty sheets in the windows instead of curtains, and that the place vibrated nonstop from the air conditioning in the market downstairs. This evening, Conklin had been on his way home when he'd gotten a tip from one K.J. Herkus, a CI and a small-time dope dealer. Herk lived and worked the streets in Chinatown, and he had recognized the narc with a short beard and John Lennon-type glasses who'd checked into the Silvestri. Herk was hoping Conklin could hook him up with the narc with the glasses, that maybe he could make himself useful from time to time. Conklin said,
Don't approach him unless I say so, okay, Herk? He's undercover. I'll look for some work for you.
Conklin had been watching the hotel for about 2 hours before Inspector Stan Whitney came out. Whitney went to the market, came out 10 minutes later with a plastic bag of something, then re-entered the hotel. Conklin thought there was a good chance that Whitney had gotten takeout for dinner and wouldn't be going out again. He thought about going into the hotel, getting Whitney's room number and knocking on the door. But he quickly quashed the idea. Whitney was likely desperate enough to introduce a loaded gun into the conversation. Conklin knew the best thing for him to do was continue to keep an eye on the door and be ready to tail the cop. Conklin called Brady. He described Whitney's denim shirt, jeans, and blue cap partially hiding his face and asked for backup in an unmarked. Brady took down the details and said,
Don't lose him.
Conklin resumed watching the door, and damn if Whitney didn't walk out and take a right, then a tight left toward Vallejo. Conklin let a car get in front of him, then pulled into traffic in time for the light to turn red. When it changed to green, he could see Whitney, still proceeding south on Stockton through Chinatown, passing shops and bakeries, hands in his pockets as if he had just gone out for a stroll. Conklin tailed Whitney without incident, watched him take a left on Clay and another left on Kearney. He followed Whitney for another 2 blocks and was just behind him when the man in denim disappeared into Portsmouth Square garage across from the Hilton. Conklin parked in a no-parking zone with a view of the garage. A silver Chevy crawled past Conklin. The man in the driver's seat was Officer Alan Benjamin, a cop Conklin knew. Conklin made radio contact with Brady, who said he was keeping a channel open and restricted to the three of them, Benjamin, Brady, and Conklin. Benjamin drove ahead, parked his unmarked in front of a hydrant up the block, and waited there. At 8:15 p.m., 10 minutes after entering the garage, a blue pickup with Texas plates rolled up out of the garage and took a right. It was Whitney. Conklin pulled ahead of Benjamin, and they took turns staying on the pickup's tail. Whitney took a left on Washington, then another left on Stockton, the main drag through Chinatown, which was still congested with trucks making deliveries, as well as pedestrians and tourists in cabs taking in the evening lights. Without warning, the truck Whitney was driving stopped at the intersection of Stockton and Bush just long enough for a thickly muscled guy to leave the sidewalk and get into the truck's passenger seat. Conklin recognized this passenger. It was Bill Brand, Whitney's partner. Neither Whitney nor Brand was in violation of the law, and stopping them would only tip them off. With two police cars shadowing it, the blue truck turned right on Sutter, went half a mile to Polk, and parked in an empty spot outside a nail salon. When they got out of the truck, Whitney and Brand were wearing blue SFPD windbreakers. They crossed the street to a gray stucco building with awnings and neon signs in the windows reading, "Payday Loans, Checks Cashed, Western Union." The check cashing store was lit up inside and open for business. As Whitney and Brand reached the door, they removed masks from their pockets and pulled them on over their faces. The entry bell over the door jingled as the cops went inside. Chapter 102. I came into our apartment and heard music coming from the bedroom. Joe was sitting up in bed in a t-shirt and boxers, his fingers on his laptop and an urban blues channel on the TV. He looked up and saw me in my slinky red dress. He whistled, and I grinned and did a little pirouette. I said, "After all these years in chinos and a blazer, I've still got it, no?" He said,
"Yes, you certainly do, Blondie."
I said, "Be right back," and turned to go in to see Julie. Joe said,
"She's across the hall with Mrs. Rose. Martha's there, too."
"Oh? Why?"
"I told Mrs. Rose I needed a few hours off to get some work done, and she said,
'It would be lovely to have some company,'"
Joe said, doing a pretty good version of Mrs. Rose's English accent. I laughed. He did Mrs. Rose so well. He patted the bed next to him, and I sat down. He asked,
"How was your dinner?"
"No kidding, it was the best time we've all had together in months," I said. "We were all there, all in great moods. Richie gave Cindy his mother's diamond in a new form." I described the pendant. I was facing away from Joe as I talked, and I lifted my hair. He zipped down my dress really slowly. I gasped. I was surprised at the heat that came over me from nowhere.
"Stand up," he said. "You don't want to wrinkle your dress."
I did what he said and watched him close the lid on the computer without taking his eyes from me. I let down the asymmetrical neckline of my dress, and when my arms were free, the red silk dropped into a puddle around my feet. He reached out his arms. I kicked off my shoes, and in the next second, by way of some deft maneuver of Joe's, I was flat on my back in my underthings, looking up into his blue, blue eyes. "Yes," I heard my phone buzz in the other room. No, I didn't take the call. I knew it was that freaking phone terrorist, and I wasn't going to let him steal this time with Joe away from me. It had been a long time since we'd been in bed without listening to the baby monitor, but we had that time now. And we took full advantage of it. His clothes flew over the side of the bed, and the blankets were shoved to the footboard. I closed my eyes and reveled in the feel of his whiskers and lips and hands on my skin and the delicious smell of him. And I loved him back. We romped and played like newlyweds, and at one point, Joe reached a hand down and helped me off the floor and back into the bed. The laughter was wonderful, and when we kissed deeply and connected completely, it felt as true as it had when we first fell in love. Afterward, sweating and panting and still entwined with Joe, I rested my cheek against his shoulder and held him tightly. I told him how much I loved him, and he said he'd never loved me more. Exhausted in the best possible way, I drifted off, telling myself that it was okay. Joe was in charge. I didn't have to worry about anything. He would get the baby and her furry pal when it was time. I was sleeping and maybe having a beautiful dream when Joe said,
"Lindsay, your phone has been ringing every minute or two."
He handed it to me. I took it reluctantly. I said, "I've been getting hang-ups," but when I looked at the caller ID, it read Conklin.
"Christ, where have you been?"
Conklin said.
Okay, never mind. Brand and Whitney tried to hold up a check cashing store. We've got dead people. We've got hostages. They're in there now.
I heard a voice over a bullhorn saying,
"Put your hands up and come out. You don't want anyone else to die, do you?"
Conklin gave me an address on Polk, which was about 3 miles and 5 minutes away. 4 if I pushed it. I started scrambling around for something to wear, and Joe turned on the lights.
"Lindsay, be safe," he said. "We want you back here. Your family loves you."
I went into his arms and we held each other tightly. I needed to go. But I knew Joe and I were thinking the same thing. We had a lot to live for. Chapter 103. A patrolman let me and my explorer through the cordon on Polk. I drove to mid-block and saw Conklin and Brady standing together in front of a nail salon on the south side of the street. Their eyes were fixed on the north side, on the checks-cashed store directly across from them. I parked in a no-parking zone a few yards down the street from Brady and Conklin, right behind a blue Ford pickup with Texas plates. I got out of my vehicle and heard sirens from cars coming in from all points. I walked up to my partner and asked, "What happened?" He pushed his hair out of his eyes, cleared his throat, and said,
"I had a tip that Whitney was staying at the Silvestri, so I staked it out. He left the hotel around 8 p.m., and I tailed him with backup. He walked to a garage on Kearney and got that truck."
He pointed at it with his chin. Then he went on.
"He picked Brand up on the corner of Stockton and Bush, both of them in street clothes. When they got out of the truck here, they were in PD windbreakers."
Car doors were slamming and cops were getting out, standing on the sidewalk, looking over the roofs of their vehicles. Radios set up a cacophony of blare and static along the street. I was wearing my vest, carrying my gun, but still, I felt naked and vulnerable. I looked more closely at the check cashing store. The signs were still lit up over the storefront, but it was dark inside the shop. Conklin said,
"One of them flipped the sign on the door to closed. The lights were on, and I saw them corral the two customers, both women, over to the left side of the store. They made them lie down, and Brand cuffed them. While Brand did that, Whitney put his gun on the security guard and walked him back to the teller's cages. I'm guessing Whitney told them, 'Open up, or I'll kill him.'"
"Shit," I said. "So they let him in."
"Right,"
Conklin said.
"By then, someone hit the alarm."
Beside me, Brady lifted his bullhorn and said,
"Whitney, Brand, I'm calling the store. Pick up the phone."
Brady was sweating in 60 degrees. You could see it on his forehead, his upper lip, but you couldn't tell he was stressing from his voice or his actions. I was glad Brady was in charge. "Keep going," I said to my partner. Conklin said,
"So I can see the teller open the security door and blam, Whitney shoots the guard. Puts that threat down. Now the tellers run for the back door and I see muzzle flare. I guess Whitney panicked or no longer cared. I think he nailed a couple of them. I didn't see them again."
Guns were everywhere on this short block. Soon SWAT would launch smoke bombs and storm checks cashed. Brady spoke through the bullhorn.
"Listen to me. This is going to end badly if you don't do exactly what I say. The store is surrounded. We've got snipers on the roof. Put the guns down and come out with your hands in the air."
A moment later, the front door opened a few inches and Whitney called,
"Don't shoot! We're coming out with hostages!"
Brady called out over the megaphone,
"Hold your fire!"
The door swung open and two terrified women with their hands behind their backs were muscled out of the store. Whitney was behind one of them, Brand behind the other. I saw the glint of their handguns and that both rotten cops had duffel bags with the shoulder straps crossing their chests, probably containing their latest and final score. I was standing with Conklin when Whitney and Brand, still wearing their creepy masks, awkwardly bumped and dragged their hostages between parked cars and toward the truck. It was only a 50-foot walk, but they were encumbered and had to pass through a shooting gallery, including right past where Brady, Conklin, and I were standing. I don't know what came over Richie. Maybe he just couldn't take what was happening. He shouted at Whitney and Brand,
"You're filth! Both of you! Fucking scum!"
Whitney lifted his gun and pointed it at Conklin. I saw my partner lift his arm, and by the time I heard the report of Whitney's gun, my own gun was in my hand. I knew Conklin was hit, but I couldn't stop what I was doing. I didn't have a clean head or chest shot, so I dropped to one knee and fired at Whitney's hip. Before his leg buckled, a few hundred bullets pinged into the sidewalk from above. Whitney dropped. The hostages ran, screaming. One of them fell on the asphalt, bleeding. Brady reached Brand in terrifying slow motion and put his gun to the back of his neck. Brand dropped his gun and put up his hands.
"I give up,"
Brand said.
"Don't shoot."
Two shots rang out, but I didn't see where they landed. My whole mind was on Conklin. He was on the ground, motionless. I stooped down next to my partner and shook his shoulder. "Richie, speak to me." Chapter 104. The small waiting room outside the ER was dull beige, and the light from the overhead fixture was flat white and glaring. Richie was in surgery. Cindy and I sat together, and she was so afraid for him, trying to hold it together, but the tears just streamed down her face. I held her hand, told her the things you say in a situation when you don't know what the fuck is going to happen. "He's going to be okay. I promise." Yuki was pacing, and Claire was in the hallway waiting for word of the outcome. Claire had checked out the surgeon and assured all of us that Dr. Starr was the best. Joe was off getting coffee, and Brady had waited with us for hours, but had gone back to the hall to tell the story again, this time to internal affairs. The last hours were running through my mind on a closed loop. I kept hearing the sharp sounds of rapid gunfire and the shrill screams of the hostages. I saw the bodies of Brand and Whitney and thought their plan had been a Hail Mary pass, that they hadn't truly expected to survive. I recalled handing my gun to Brady, then climbing into the ambulance that was taking Rich to the hospital. I was supposed to stay at the scene, but there was no way that could happen. No way. Neck injuries were serious, mostly fatal. Richie. My dear friend, my partner. My brother. He could die. I remembered calling Cindy from the ambulance and hearing her panicked screams. And I remembered calling Joe, saying, "I'm okay." Now, in the hospital waiting room, he put a tray of coffee containers down on a table, sat down next to me, and held my hand. A moment after that, we were all on our feet as the doctor entered the room. He was a small man with a goatee and long fingers. He said,
"Inspector Conklin is out of surgery, and I have good news. The bullet hit his left forearm, breaking it and deflecting the bullet, slowing it down. That was a lucky thing for Inspector Conklin. Because the bullet was deflected, instead of severing his arteries or spine, it grazed his neck. He had a ragged wound that caused him to collapse and bleed like crazy, but he's all stitched up and his arm has been set. He's going to be fine."
"Who is Cindy?"
Dr. Starr asked. Cindy stood up, her face pink and gleaming with tears.
"That's me."
Dr. Starr said,
"He's really going to be okay, my dear. He said to tell you he loves you."
Cindy said,
"Thank God."
And she sat back down from the weight of relief and emotion. We were all emoting, thanking both God and Dr. Starr, and tears were springing from all eyes. When my phone rang, I said to Joe, "It's probably Brady." But when I looked at the caller ID, I was shocked to see who was calling me. It was Vasquez. Where was he? Did he know that his partner, Ted Swanson, was in the ICU? That Kyle Robertson was dead? That Brand's and Whitney's bodies were at the morgue? I fumbled the phone, then stabbed the talk button. "Boxer," I said. The voice that came over Vasquez's phone did not belong to Vasquez. It was male, unaccented, unfamiliar.
"There's been a terrible accident, Sergeant Boxer, and Vasquez himself couldn't place the call.
Who is this?
Just listen. Vasquez can't contact anyone, you understand what I'm saying? He's lying in the Wicker House parking lot. But Vasquez is not important. Here's what is. I want what was taken from me. 3 million in cash, 200 pounds of synthetic marijuana, and 100 kilos of high-grade heroin. I said, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, you do. It's your case. You're in charge. I hope you know who you're dealing with.
Who is this? I asked again. I'm called Kingfisher. Ask around. You'll be hearing from me again soon, Lindsay Boxer. You can count on it.
The phone went dead in my hand.
Joe said,
Linz? Who was that?
I stuttered, some dirtbag who has been harassing me.
If only Kingfisher were your ordinary dirtbag. But he was anything but ordinary. He topped the list of the most ruthless drug lords in the country. Wanted for drug trafficking, torture, murder, and organized crime up and down the length of California, and many points east. And now the king was here. His investment at Wicker House had been stolen by cops, and he wasn't writing it off as the cost of doing business. He'd been unable to recover his property from Calhoun or Vasquez. Robertson, Brand, and Whitney were also dead. The only living person who might know the whereabouts of the Wicker House Hall was a dirty cop known as One. Real name Edward Ted Swanson, who'd been hospitalized with multiple gunshot wounds and wasn't expected to live. So Kingfisher was targeting me.
Continue listening to hear an excerpt from James Patterson's Truth or Die.
Where exactly did it happen? I asked.
West End Avenue at 73rd. The taxi was stopped at a red light, said Lamont. The assailant smashed the driver's side window, pistol-whipped the driver until he was knocked out cold and grabbed his money bag. He then robbed Miss Parker at gunpoint.
Claire, I said.
Excuse me?
Please call her Claire. I knew it was a weird thing for me to say, but weirder still was hearing Lamont refer to Claire as Ms. Parker. Not that I blamed him. Victims are always Mr., Mrs., or Ms. for a detective. He was supposed to call her that. I just wasn't ready to hear it.
I apologize,
I said.
It's just that... Don't worry about it,
he said with a raised palm. He understood. He got it.
So, what happened next?
I asked. What went wrong?
We're not sure exactly. Best we can tell, she fully cooperated. Didn't put up a fight.
That made sense. Claire might have been your prototypical tough New Yorker, but she was also no fool. She didn't own anything she'd risk her life to keep.
Does anyone?
No, she definitely knew the drill. Never be a statistic. If your taxi gets jacked, you do exactly as told.
And you said the driver was knocked out, right?
He didn't hear anything? I asked.
Not even the gunshots, said Lamont. In fact, he didn't actually regain consciousness until after the first two officers arrived at the scene.
Who called it in?
An older couple walking nearby.
What did they see?
The shooter running back to his car, which was behind the taxi. They were 30 or 40 yards away. They didn't get a good look.
Any other witnesses?
You'd think, but no. Then again, residential block, after midnight, he said. We'll obviously follow up in the area tomorrow. Talk to the driver, too. He was taken to St. Luke's before we arrived.
I leaned back in my chair, a metal hinge somewhere below the seat creaking its age. I must have had a dozen more questions for Lamont, each one trying to get me that much closer to being in the taxi with Claire, to knowing what had really happened, to knowing whether or not it truly was fucking random. But I wasn't fooling anyone, not Lamont, and especially not myself. All I was doing was procrastinating, trying hopelessly to avoid asking the one question whose answer I was truly dreading. I couldn't avoid it any longer.
For the record, you were never in here, said Lamont, pausing at a closed door toward the back corner of the precinct house.
I stared at him blankly as if I were some chronic sufferer of short-term memory loss.
In where? I asked.
He smirked. Then he opened the door. The windowless room I followed him into was only slightly bigger than claustrophobic. After closing the door behind us, Lamont introduced me to his partner, Detective Mike McGeary, who was at the helm of what looked like one of those video arcade games where you sit in a captain's chair shooting at alien spaceships on a large screen. He was even holding what looked like a joystick. McGeary, square-jawed and bald, gave Lamont a sideways glance that all but screamed, "What the hell is he doing in here?"
"Mr. Mann was a close acquaintance of the victim," said Lamont.
He added a slight emphasis on my last name, as if to jog his partner's memory. McGeary studied me in the dim light of the room until he put my face and name together. Perhaps he was remembering the cover of the New York Post a couple of years back. "An Honest Man," read the headline.
"Yeah, fine," McGeary said finally.
It wasn't exactly a ringing endorsement, but it was enough to consider the issue of my being there resolved. I could stay. I could see the recording. I could watch, frame by frame, the murder of the woman I loved. Lamont hadn't had to tell me there was a surveillance camera in the taxi. I'd known right away, given how he'd described the shooting over the phone, some of the details he had. There were little things no eyewitnesses could ever provide. Had there been any eyewitnesses, that is. Lamont removed his glasses, wearily pinching the bridge of his nose. No one ever truly gets used to the graveyard shift.
"Any matches so far?"
he asked his partner. McGeary shook his head. I glanced at the large monitor which had shifted into screensaver mode, an NYPD logo floating about. Lamont, I could tell, was waiting for me to ask him about the space-age console, the reason I wasn't supposed to be in the room. The machine obviously did a little more than just digital playback. But I didn't ask. I already knew. I'm sure the thing had an official name, something ultra-high-tech sounding, but back when I was in the DA's office, I'd only ever heard it referred to by its nickname, Crackerjack. What it did was combine every known recognition software program into one giant cross-referencing decoder that was linked to practically every criminal database in the country, as well as those from 23 other countries, or basically all of our official allies in the War on Terror. In short, given any image at any angle of any suspected terrorist, Crackerjack could source a litany of identifying characteristics, be it an exposed mole or tattoo, the exact measurements between the suspect's eyes, ears, nose, and mouth, or even a piece of jewelry. Clothing, too. Apparently, for all the precautions terrorists take in their planning, it rarely occurs to them that wearing the same polyester shirt in London, Cairo, and Islamabad might be a bad idea. Of course, it didn't take long for law enforcement in major cities, where crackerjacks were heavily deployed by the Department of Homeland Security, to realize that these machines didn't have to identify just terrorists. Anyone with a criminal record was fair game. So here was McGeary going through the recording sent over by the New York Taxi and Limousine Commission to see if any image of the shooter triggered a match. And here was me, having asked if I could watch it too.
"Mike, cue it up from the beginning, will you?" said Lamont.
McGeary punched a button and then another until the screen lit up with the first frame, the taxi having pulled over to pick Claire up. The image was grainy, black and white, like on an old tube television with a set of rabbit ears. But what little I could see was still way too much. It was exactly as Lamont had described it. The shooter smashes the driver's side window, beating the driver senseless with the butt of his gun. He's wearing a dark turtleneck and a ski mask with holes for the eyes, nose, and mouth. His gloves are tight, like those isotoners that O.J. Simpson pretended didn't fit. So far, Claire is barely visible. Not once can I see her face. Then I do. It's right after the shooter snatches the driver's money bag. He swings his gun, aiming it at Claire in the back seat. She jolts. There's no plexiglass divider. There's nothing but air. Presumably he says something to her, but the back of his head is toward the camera. Claire offers up her purse. He takes it, and she says something. I was never any good at reading lips. He should be leaving, running away. Instead, he swings out and around, opening the rear door. He's out of frame for no more than 3 seconds. Then all I see is his outstretched arm and the fear in her eyes. He fires 2 shots at point-blank range. Did he panic? Not enough to flee right away. Quickly, he rifles through her pockets and then tears off her earrings, followed by her watch, the Rolex Milgauss I gave her for her 30th birthday. He dumps everything in her purse and takes off. Wait a minute, I said suddenly. Go back a little bit. Lamont and McGeary both turned to me, their eyes asking if I was crazy. You want to watch her being murdered a second time? No, I didn't. Not a chance. Watching it the first time made me so nauseous I thought I'd throw up right there on the floor. I wanted that recording erased, deleted, destroyed for all eternity, not 2 seconds after it was used to catch the goddamn son of a bitch who'd done this. Then I wanted a long, dark alley in the dead of night where he and I could have a little time alone together. Yeah, that's what I wanted. But I thought I saw something. Up until that moment, I hadn't known what I was looking for in the recording, if anything. If Claire had been standing next to me, she, with her love of landmark Supreme Court cases, would have described it as the definition of pornography according to Justice Potter Stewart in Jacob Ellis v. Ohio. I know it when I see it. She'd always admired the simplicity of that. Not everything that's true has to be proven, she used to say. Where to? Asked McGeary, his hand hovering over a knob that could rewind frame by frame if need be. Just after he beats the driver, I said. He nodded. Say when. I watched the sped-up images, everything happening in reverse. If only I could reverse it all for real. I was waiting for the part when the gun was turned on Claire. A few moments before that, actually. Stop, I said. Right there. McGeary hit play again, and I leaned in, my eyes glued to the screen. Meanwhile, I could feel Lamont's eyes glued to my profile, as if he could somehow better see what I was looking for by watching me.
What is it?
He eventually asked. I stepped back, shaking my head as if disappointed.
Nothing, I said. It wasn't anything.
Because that's exactly what Claire would have wanted me to say. A little white lie for the greater good, she would have called it. She was always a quick thinker. Right up until the end. No way in hell did I feel like taking a taxi home. In fact, I didn't feel like going home at all. In my mind, I'd already put my apartment on the market, packed up all my belongings, and moved to another neighborhood, maybe even out of Manhattan altogether. Claire was the city to me. Bright, vibrant, alive. And now she wasn't. I passed a bar, looking through the window at the smattering of patrons, to put it politely, who were still drinking at 3 in the morning. I could see an empty stool, and it was calling my name. More like shouting it, really. Don't, I told myself. When you sober up, she'll still be gone. I kept walking in the direction of my apartment, but with every step it became clear where I truly wanted to go. It was wherever Claire had been going. Who was she meeting? Suddenly, I was channeling Oliver Stone, somehow trying to link her murder to the story she'd been chasing. But that was crazy. I saw her murder in black and white. It was a robbery. She was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and as much as that was a cliche, so too was her death. She'd be the first to admit it. Imagine that, I could hear her saying. A victim of violent crime in New York City. How original. Still, I'd become fixated on wanting to know where she'd been heading when she left my apartment. A $200 an hour shrink would probably call that sublimated grief, while the $400 an hour shrink would probably counter with sublimated anger. I was sticking with overwhelming curiosity. I put myself in her shoes, mentally tracing her steps through the lobby of my building and out to the sidewalk. As soon as I pictured her raising her arm for a taxi, it occurred to me. The driver. He at least knew the address. For sure, Claire gave it to him when he picked her up. Almost on cue, a taxi slowed down next to me at the curb, the driver wondering if I needed a ride. That was a common occurrence late at night when supply far outweighed demand. As I shook him off, I began thinking of what else Claire's driver might remember when Lamont interviewed him. Tough to say after the beating he took. Maybe the shooter had said something that would key his identity, or at least thin out the suspects. Did he speak with any kind of accent? Or maybe the driver had seen something that wasn't visible to that surveillance camera. Eye color? An odd-shaped mole? A chipped tooth? Unfortunately, the list of possibilities didn't go on and on. The ski mask, turtleneck, and gloves made sure of that. Clearly, the bastard knew that practically every taxi in the city was its own little recording studio. So much for cameras being a deterrent. As the old expression goes, show me a 10-foot wall, and I'll show you an 11-foot ladder. The 20 blocks separating me from my apartment were a daze. I was on autopilot, one foot in front of the other. Only at the sound of the keys as I dropped them on my kitchen counter did I snap out of it, realizing I was actually home. Fully dressed, I fell into my bed, shoes and all. I didn't even bother turning off the lights. But my eyes were closed for only a few seconds before they popped open. Damn. All it took was one breath, one exchange of the air around me, and I was lying there feeling more alone than I ever had in my entire life. The sheets still smelled of her. I sat up, looking over at the other side of the bed. The pillow. I could still make out the impression of Claire's head. That was the word, wasn't it? Impression. Hers was everywhere, most of all on me. I was about to make a beeline to my guest room, which, if anything, would smell of dust or staleness or whatever other odor is given off by a room that's rarely, if ever, used. I didn't care, so long as it wasn't her. Suddenly, though, I froze. Something had caught my eye. It was the yellow legal pad on the end of the bed, the one Claire had used when she took the phone call. She'd ripped off the top sheet she'd written on. But the one beneath it. This has been a Hachette audio production of 14th Deadly Sin. Written by James Patterson and Maxine Petro. Read by January Lavoie. Produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Recorded by Maddie Argyropoulos. Post-production by Chris Howerton and Merlin Music, New York City. 14th Deadly Sin is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by James Patterson. Excerpt from Truth or Die, copyright 2015 by James Patterson. Audio production, copyright 2015, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.